they'll lead a short meditation, and then we'll do our graduation oral exam, which we'll talk about a little bit. And then they'll each give a short Dharma talk, and we'll have one final question, and then we'll celebrate. So that's how we roll tonight. And I would like to request that if you haven't already, that you turn off your cell phone or you put it in airplane mode.
So welcome everyone to this very auspicious and joyous occasion. I'm quite aware, and I felt a need to speak from my heart that this joyous occasion is occurring against the shadow of a very devastating event that we're all aware of. Right? So this one individual whose mind was really in pain and really clouded by ignorance and confusion and self-loathing has taken the lives of many. And so we grieve and we hold in our hearts the people that suffered loss. And through our practice, we hold in our hearts the person who also was so filled with pain and hatred that he was led to do this event. And we make prayers for all those who suffer hatred, that they may find their hatred really healed in the face of understanding and compassion, so these kinds of acts can end in the world altogether. And because of this, we vow to take our practice out into the world, to speak out against oppression and injustice. We vow to become protectors for those who are in need of protection. And we practice Buddha's teachings to guide us to an awakened heart and awakened mind. And the Buddha instructed and gave us these beautiful instructions. He said, "Others will kill, we shall not kill. Thus should we direct our hearts. Others will be cruel, we will not be cruel. Thus should we direct our hearts. Others will speak falsely, we shall not speak falsely. Thus should we direct our hearts. Others will be fraudulent. We shall not be fraudulent. Thus shall we direct our hearts. Others will be hateful. We shall become loving. Thus shall we direct our hearts. Others will become ignorant. We shall become wise. Thus shall we direct our hearts." So this is our aspiration, right? And it isn't easy. And we're not there yet, most of us, you know, if we're normal human beings. And because of this, we need to practice. We need to put it into practice. One of my favorite stories about this of all times is the one with Marty Seligman, who is considered the father of modern psychology. And I've told this story before, but I love it. I can't stop telling it, you know. And he was gardening one day, and he talks about, when he tells the story, you know, he would say, I take gardening really seriously, like really seriously. And for me, it's all, you know, got to get it all done and get the weeds pulled and the things cut and all that. And his six-year-old daughter, Nikki, was dancing around, throwing the weeds in the air, throwing the leaves in the air, and generally making a big mess of whatever he was doing. And at that point, Marty Seligman snapped at his daughter, like, just stop making a mess and, you know, help me out. And she looked up at him. I think she may have only been five. No, she was six, that's right. She said, Daddy, you know, did you notice when I was five I whined a lot? And he said, yes, I did. He said, well, Daddy, have you noticed that since I turned six I haven't been whining at all? And he said, you know, Nikki, now that you've mentioned it, you're right. You haven't been whining. And she said, well, Daddy, it's because on my birthday, I decided not to ever whine again. And if I can stop whining, you can stop being so grumpy. And it was at that moment that he realized that the mind can change through practice, right? Which is what the whole message, the whole pith of what the Buddha taught is. We have wonderful, wonderful teachings on science. We have wonderful teachings on the external universe in our culture. But when we practice and look at those things, the mind doesn't change, the heart doesn't change, the heart doesn't transform. So we do this, we practice this to transform our own hearts and minds and thus transform the world. And we do this spiritual practice, walk the spiritual path, to have a heart of awakening, a mind of awakening. So, next slide. Jay's doing double duty. I love and repeat this definition from Geshe Lodin, that an enlightened mind is a mind which is filled with the greatest, most far-reaching love. It's completely free of ignorant hatred, ignorant attachment, and ignorance itself. It's fused with wisdom and compassion. It's an unstoppable wellspring of happiness, peace, and contentment. It's filled with a boundless joy and no limitation to creating beneficial circumstances reflecting that joy. Anyone want to sign up for that? So the Buddha said, this is our birthright. This is why we're in the world, to really awaken this heart and this mind. And the idea is it's available to all of us. It's not like it's one Buddha out there or one God out there that is so separate from us. It's that this is what we ourselves can awaken. And so the idea is that we can become, the Buddhism doesn't have a lockdown on an awakened heart and mind, it's one way, but you could become a Tara, you can become a Buddha, you could become a Manjushri, you can become a Mother Mary or a Christ. All of those embody this awakened heart mind. And so I thought, again, I would do a quick review of the path as it's presented in Buddhism so it could understand the context of why today is such a joyous and momentous occasion. Because this is the culmination of a long study and a long practice. And so I want you to have a little taste of what these two have done, right? In Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, because it began in India and came to Tibet, there's developed a spiritual path, which has a whole culture that supported it. So it has a whole cultural context, and within that, there were four schools of Buddhism that developed: the Nyingmapa, the Sakyas, the Kagyus, and the Gelugpas. There's no test on this. You don't have to know afterwards. It's just so you get this whole framework. And then what we are, what Jay and Ryan have been studying is Gelugpa. And the Gelugpa school mainly teaches and focuses on what's called the Lamrim. It actually traces its origin back to Shakyamuni Buddha, and as all Buddhist schools do. And then the lineage was brought from India to Tibet by the great man, and it traces its origin back to the great Kadampa master, Lord Atisha. And then it was founded by Jetsongkhapa, Lobsang Drakpa, who was also the founder of the whole tradition of the Dalai Lama. So this is the lineage of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And the foundational teaching of Lamrim is what basically every Gelugpa practitioner, monk, nun, teacher will practice and know and be familiar with. And it's like the steps, the how-to guide to enlightenment from A to Z, starting with nothing and getting, you know, up to enlightenment. And when you go through the monastery, you do 10, 15, 20 years of practice, and you become often ordained at a very young age, sometimes 6, 7, sometimes even younger. And then some of those kids grow up and they leave the monastery and they go to their own home villages and they teach. And others stay and they get what's basically a PhD called a Geshe degree. And when you get a Geshe degree, you get a big yellow hat, which we sadly don't have here to give to these two. So what these two have been doing is basically a short course at Geshe Michael boiled down all the essential things that you need to know from your Geshe degree. And he put it into a study of 18 courses, and that's what we have been doing together. These come from different source texts from India, and you study Abhidharma, Prajnaparamita, Madhyamika, logic, and vowed morality. Those are the five great topics. And each one you can see has different texts that are fundamental texts. And these are all woven in to the course of study that Jay and Ryan did. And each one of these, we're not the only Gelugpa tradition in the United States. So FPMT, which is Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa's tradition, which is some of our teachers at Diamond Light come and teach in that tradition, like Venerable Palmo came and taught us recently, Lama Elaine's coming, and will be teaching a Lamrim, of course. And so they boiled the same course of study down to 14 modules, and then they have another advanced level of study. And then Gelug Rinpoche also, he came up with a course of study of 13. And if you look, every single one of them, in their own way, in their own flavor, hit all the topics that you would study in the monastery. And then Asian Classics Institute. This is what these guys have been studying for the last, 6 years? Yeah, 7? We've lost count. And each one of these courses has 10 classes plus a review class with homework and quizzes and final exams and meditations. And so it takes a long, dedicated route of study to go through and practice. And you can go through them and not do all of the work. That's fine. What this is, when you actually do this Maroc and you finish it, what you've done is you've come away with a Maroc degree that says, I can teach this. Right? That's what's extraordinary about it. Because what that is that's a complete dedication to doing this for someone and something beyond yourself. It's not just, for me, but I love this material. I've been touched by this so deeply that I'm going to dedicate myself to making it available and keeping it available in the world. All these actually become the foundation for Vajrayana practice, which are the higher, what's sometimes called the higher courses of. And the reason that we have Sutrayana and Vajrayana is that the Buddha taught that in Sutrayana you can reach enlightenment, but it takes count, like, what is it, 10 countless eons? And he said, well, if you want to speed that up and you really have this burning passion to save the world, then you could do Tantra to gain enlightenment in this lifetime, to be ready to use the process of death for liberation if you haven't reached it by then, and also to just load the karmic dice so that if you don't reach enlightenment in this lifetime, which we don't even like to say that, but you've loaded the karmic dice so fully that your chances of returning in the next life as a human being who has a connection with Dharma are very high. So that's what they have been doing in the context of Diamond Light Tibetan Buddhist Group, which is an umbrella organization where we're teaching the Gelugpa tradition in these different forms and formats with different teachers, following the traditional course of study, with the intention that every being in Sacramento and beyond have the true, authentic path to enlightenment available to them, which is huge. And Diamond Light isn't anything different than those of us in this room. Right? So it's not like some big organization out there. It's us. And it's the next... I thought I'd give the snapshot of people who have participated over the years. So you can see that it's been the dedicated... I don't want to say project, aspiration, hope to bring this into the world over the many years. So I hope this gives you some appreciation for the course of study and the dedication they've had and the context that we're really in this Indo-Tibetan traditional course of study in a modern way that isn't any less rigorous or any, it takes a little less time. You don't have to learn Tibetan. But it's not leaving out anything essential. There are no essential ingredients left out. That's what I'm going to say. So thanks for being here to celebrate this with them, because we're about to have two new teachers come into the world to help us carry on this very vital, important tradition that this beautiful and troubled world needs. So, Ryan and Jane, would you please? No, sorry, that wasn't the end. You were like already celebrating. We're done. Can you please come take your seats?
Short meditation. So I'm going to do a short chanting for like 1 minute or 2 minutes, and then Ryan will lead the meditation. So when I'm chanting, try to focus your 100% attention on my voice. Thank you.
Take a breath in. And do a slow exhale. Again, breathe in. Long exhale. One more time. Make sure you're sitting upright. I know this really wise teacher that likes to say your spine is the antenna for your soul. So make sure it's fully extended upwards towards the sky. Shoulders are relaxed. Jaw, your lips are soft, no tension. Your tongue is relaxed. Soften your whole body. Become aware of your breath. Anywhere that feels comfortable, could be at your stomach or in your chest or at the level of your nose. Tie your mind to your breath. Don't think about anything else. Let your exhales sink you deeper into relaxation. It's like every exhale there's this, it's like letting go of any stress or tension from your day. that relaxation. And on your inhales, breathe in brightness, vividness of attention. So you stay relaxed, but you become more present, more awake within that relaxation with every inhale. Just for another minute, ride your breath, relaxing on the exhales, and brightening on the inhales. Become aware of your body in general, your whole body. Your body in this room with four walls, a ceiling, and a roof or a floor. And when you're ready, you can release the meditation. I don't know what we do next.
Well, chillier when you're sitting on the floor.
Yeah. So I wanted to add my congratulations to these two guys for being here tonight. This isn't like a 200-hour teacher training. This what they've been through to get here is like thousands of hours of study. I mean, it's a real... They took the Geshe program, from the 20-year Geshe program from the Pilpa tradition, and they condensed it, but it's not all that condensed. So there's 18 courses, and there's at least 10 classes in each course, and hundreds of hours of class time, and homeworks, and as you know, quizzes, final exams. And so what we've done is we've taken kind of some of the highlights of the course questions that they've studied over the years. And we're gonna quiz them and see how well they've done in their studies. So if you'll each take a question. Let's start with one each and pass them on. And then if somebody didn't get one, we wanna start with the really sexy questions and the tough questions, so. So this is round one, and if we have time, we'll go further than that. So let me know if there's enough for everybody to have a question. And then let's pass that around again until they're all gone.
I didn't get one.
You didn't get one?
No.
You take one and pass it on.
Did you get one, David?
Oh, I didn't get one. No, but I'm kind of directing traffic here, so I don't really need a question. I may think of one on my own. And then, are you guys ready?
Yes.
For your Marok. Marok means like guide, so if they succeeded this the contest of ours, then they will become guides or teachers in this tradition. So let's start anywhere. Who wants to start?
Are there guidelines on their answer?
Are there guidelines
like,
on their...
It doesn't have to be exact.
No, well, we can sort of evaluate it, and then you can also ask follow-up questions. If you feel like there's some area that you want them to explain a little bit more, we can go into that. So do you want to start, and then we'll go...
Do I pick who I ask, or I just ask one of them?
There are a couple of two or three questions that have somebody's name on them. Otherwise, you can ask just anybody you want.
Or three.
Let's go back and forth.
Back and forth, yeah. One.
Who goes first?
I'll pick Ryan. I'll go first.
Okay.
Name the four white deeds, and for each, explain the black deed for which it acts as an antidote.
Okay. The four white deeds. The first one is. The first and the last are kind of similar. So the first one is not telling or being honest like all the time. Impeccable with your truth. So that is an antidote for the black deed of deceiving your lama. The second one is... What's the second one? Always like guiding people towards kindness, towards the bodhisattva ideal, like love and compassion and wisdom. That's the antidote for the black deed of making someone feel bad about doing virtuous activities. Like someone did something really good, and you were like, why'd you do that? That's stupid. Like, you wouldn't want to do that. Just like dissing them in some way. The next one, the white deed of seeing the world is like totally pure, is the antidote for getting angry at... I'm just going to say getting angry at like anyone and just like blurting out, but the answer says getting angry at like a bodhisattva, high-level bodhisattva. And the fourth one, again, is like maintaining an honest character, demeanor. And that is an antidote for being like deceptive and evil and cruel.
Yep. So for the first one, you were right, never speaking a lie to anyone. And it says, even in jest, so not even when you're kidding, telling a lie. Second one's right, third one's... Also, try to see every person or thing you encounter as being absolutely pure and conceive of every living being as the teacher himself.
Yeah, I'll have one for Dave. Give the short version of the standard definition of a mental affliction.
Mental affliction is some mental function that ruins or destroys the peace of your mind.
That's right. Well done.
A little easier than Ryan.
Just a little.
We just go around from in some orderly fashion. So somebody next to Dasha, and then we can.
Okay, I think Jim. Thank you.
Well, there were two people. I didn't want to.
Okay. Jay, this one's for you. Quote from memory: the lines that describe the immediate cause of anger and the usefulness of this cause. It says Tibetan track in Tibetan.
Say the question again.
Quote from memory, the lines that describe the immediate cause of anger and the usefulness of this cause. Tibetan track in Tibetan.
Immediate cause of anger. Immediate cause of anger is ignorance or mental affliction.
does.
It's the one from Master Shanti Deva?
I don't know.
Okay.
Is there something?
Yeah. It starts with if there's something.
Yeah, if there is something you can do, I worry. But that question doesn't make sense. If there is something you cannot do, then why worry?
He's contesting the question.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't
know. Yeah, and in answering these questions, feel free to draw on your own personal experience where it's appropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Ryan, am I supposed to get each one of them one, or am I supposed to wait?
You can wait for your the second round if you like.
All right, Ryan, what reasoning can be used to decide whether the people and experiences from the earlier part of our life were somehow spiritually significant?
Sure, so the reasoning that you can use is that basically you can revise your memories. So. Say you go through some hardship, like a breakup or something like that, and it sucks, and it's really difficult, and it's painful, and maybe for a certain period of time in your life, those memories bring up difficult feelings for you, and you're like, why did this happen? You know, like, you're like mourning it, right? But then after a certain period of time, maybe you can look at that experience as teaching you something, like helping you in some way, like helping you grow or learn, and like changing you for the better, or something like that. So that's kind of a proof that experiences and memories don't just mean one thing. They aren't concrete poured out that hardens and just stays one thing. You can revise memories. You can change the meaning of memories so that they can be significant for you. The more you practice, the more you realize, or maybe you get curious about, like, why did something happen in my life? Like, maybe, like, why did this difficulty happen? And it might make sense that it was there for a reason. Like, it was good that it happened to you. You could come to that conclusion later, so.
Yeah,
this is
better. Your explanation was better than
the
answer.
can I
now we have two people contesting.
Can I do some comments on that too? Because that is very real for me. Like, I had a lot of grudges, anger, and hurts from a lot of people in my past. And then, you know, 6 years back when I started Buddhist studies, one of the teaching I got is the teaching of Lojong, which actually first time from Brandy, and it really sunk into me. And there are practices like exchanging self and other, Tonglen, and the eight verses. And I never knew that the actions that I did out of anger or getting back to somebody, that I actually thought that I'm doing better by doing that. And then, but actually I was burning with anger and hurt inside. I used these practices and was able to totally forgive all of them. And actually, right now, I actually thank them because they were the funnel through which I actually got to practice this. Otherwise, it will be just intellectual. If I had not those experiences given to me, I wouldn't have this realization. The teachers and the people and others are also equally important to have that real embodied experience. So it is a spiritual revisionism. So I went back and did that to many other people. And then right now I don't have any grudge for anybody in my past. So that question, that spiritual revisionism is very real for me. Thank you.
Causes why a person might break their bodhisattva vows?
Yeah, the first cause is actually not knowing about the bodhisattva vows. Just knowing the verbal meaning or intellectual understanding is not enough. there are different layers of how you can break. And so that is that you have to actually get from a teacher who practices that. So not having that teaching or not knowing that is the first cause. Second can be out of laziness. He knows that, but he's really lazy. He's like, oh, this is small, so I don't have to be careful. That is another cause. Third one can be a mental affliction. Mental affliction is the first cause, something that ruins, first question that Dasha asked, something that ruins your mental peace very fast. It is not, it's so fast that you don't have any control. So a bodhisattva, if somebody has taken a vow, he may have good intention, good knowledge, no laziness, but the mental affliction can be so fast that he don't have any control on that. That is it. Third one. The fourth one is like, it's also kind of mental affliction. It is, he actually took it, but he's not serious. He's intentionally willing to break it. Those are the four ways people can break a vow. Any question?
The fourth, it says disrespect the vows. Is that the same?
Yeah, disrespect the vow by intention, taking the vow and intentionally breaking it. That is a disrespect.
Alright, Ryan.
I've got a bad feeling about this one.
Also, the mark number 92, where the other edit that didn't seem like that big of a hole. question is,
can I test the number 3?
In what sense are other living beings more precious than a gem that could give you anything you wished for?
I don't really like the answer that it gives on this, so. But it doesn't really make sense. Well, the way that it's asked, it's not really answering it. But you could think of it in two ways. A wish-giving gem is kind of like Aladdin's lamp, like this gem that gives you whatever you want. So even if you were given this like wish-giving gem, the mind of like a Buddha and an enlightened being is something that's like way beyond like what we could even conceptualize. Like you can't even, you can think about it and hear about it and have like your own ideas, but the actual reality of it is beyond what like we as humans can grasp or touch or taste. So even if you had this like Aladdin's lamp, this wish-giving jewel, you wouldn't even know like what to ask for. You know, you could say it would it's just beyond like what you could ask for. But why are people more precious than a wish-giving gem? You could only wish for something in this life, or even like jewelry or any kind of gem can help you in this life, momentarily, temporarily. Might make you feel good if you get a piece of jewelry that you're like, I look great right now, or like some, you trade it in for money and you can buy food with it or something like that. Like it can only help you in this life, but if you're kind to people and you serve other people, that creates imprints in your mind that, or plants seeds in your mind that can help you in the next life or any lifetime after that. It can also help you in this life too, so people are actually more valuable than anything really for like your ability to become enlightened or to change your mind. That's what I think about that question.
You got extra credit according to mine.
It's on the next. Okay. What reasoning does Master Shantideva use to prove that we are capable of watching our minds closely and keeping them away from anger and the like?
Okay. Master Shantideva uses this example. Like if you are given a bowl of oil, which is full of oil, and then if a knife is put or a sword is put on your throat, and somebody asks you to walk across the road without dropping even a single draw, you will do that so carefully. So you'll have perfect concentration at that time. Mm-hmm. So if that can be done without any practice or without, you know, and if anybody can do that, then we can actually train our mind to do that for a good cause.
Good.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
This is for you, Ryan. Name the two consistent, quote unquote, consistent consequences for each of the 10 non-virtues following the sutra, the 10 levels, and some other works.
Okay. For killing, this is a 20-parter. I might have this one. So for killing, your life is short. The result will be your life is short, and you'll be sick. You won't be very healthy. Stealing, you won't have much property. You won't have like very many things, and the things that you do have will be common property with other people. Sexual misconduct, the people that you work with will not be so great, and you'll have trouble keeping a partner. Lying, even if you speak the truth, people won't believe you, and then people will appear deceptive to you also. What's the next one? Divisive speech. The people in your life will be like fighting all the time. Like that, and then the people that you interact with will have, what does it say, unfavorable characters or something like that, undesirable characters. Yeah. Let's see, harsh speech. There will be like loud, abrupt noises in your environment. Like my dad would cook and just like pots and pans, loud. like how do you pull a pot out of a drawer like that loud? When you interact with people, so your speech was harsh, right? You like were harsh with people, so then it'll appear like people are fighting with you, or people want to start a fight with you or something with their language. Idle chatter, gossip. The second one is you, well, the first one, which one? Your words won't carry any weight. Even if you have something to contribute and it's like significant, people won't really care. I think of like Facebook, like you post something and like no one even looks at it. It's like, what? And then the second one is you have a lack of confidence. Craving, your personality is, you just like crave things all the time. You're afflicted with desire all of the time. And even if you do get things, you're not satisfied. That's kind of the nature of desire anyways. It's like, this chocolate's really good, so I want it even more. I'm not like, that was good. Like, it's like, anyways. Let's see. Ill will. One always blanks in my mind. Let's see. You have like the tendency to hurt people. Even on accident, you're just like hurting people and people will hurt you. That's the second one. I forget the first. What's the first one?
I think you'll be always blaming people and people will be blaming you. Not in that, but that's my two cents. You always hear people blaming you and hurting you.
You're always finding yourself without help.
Oh yeah, that's right. It's the hand with like the water. Yeah, exactly. So anytime if you're in trouble, you'll find yourself without help. And then the last one is wrong worldview. So I use like images to remember this stuff. So Donald Trump, sorry if anyone like likes Donald Trump. You have like this, you harbor like. You
are, I like him.
Cool. you're like, you carry views that are like harmful for the world. And then, what's the second part? Oh yeah, you're deceptive. Yourself.
Excellent. Okay. You want the long or the short one?
Short.
Yeah.
You asked.
No, I did. The 8th century master Dharmakirti, in his root text on Buddhist logic, says that two elements must be present for tantra to work. Name.
Yeah, two elements should be there for tantra to work. The first one is the person who is giving you the word of tantra or teaching you the tantra should be a person of higher realization. And the second one is, even if you get that, it will work only if you actually lead a pure life.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
Thank you.
Okay. It's for either one of you.
Right.
Oh, it's your turn. Okay. Do you think that it is true that every event in our present kind of life is suffering? Why or why not?
Oh, dang, the second part. All right. I was going to say yes. So is every part of our present life suffering? Is that the question? Let's talk about it, I guess. Suffering of body, so you can get paper cuts or stub your toe or like feel uncomfortably hot in a room or uncomfortably cold. Headaches. What else? Diarrhea, upset stomachs, toothaches. Like your body can be this incredible source of suffering.
He's so young. When he was older, we could come up with some
better.
He shouldn't even touch it, but yeah.
I was hanging out with my aunt and uncle, and the big topic of conversation was doctors that they were seeing and all this. I was like, wow, this is so different. Your emotions, you know, like anger and jealousy and like fear, all this stuff are sources that's like available to experience and suffering. The very nature of like having things means that they're going to be gone. So that because anything exists, it will leave. Because you're born, you're gonna die. So attached to having anything, not saying that they're not good, like I'll enjoy, you know, this chocolate or friendship or partnership or whatever it is, it still like can bring you pleasurable feelings, but it will leave. And you don't know when. Like I remember coming here and then I came here the other day with like shoes, I had gotten new shoes, right? And then I left the room and they were gone, right? So like you don't know when things are gonna leave you. You don't know if you're gonna get hit by a car outside. You don't know if your friends are gonna die. I've had plenty of people in my life die and I didn't know. They, you know, just show up to work and one of my coworkers, Brad, did you remember Brad at Abhishek? No? Anyways, this like older gentleman, he was like healthy, and then one day he just wasn't there because he died of a heart attack. Like, the girl that sat in front of me in sixth grade got hit by a car. She just wasn't there when we came to school one day. So you don't know when these things are going to happen, which is a source of like uneasiness in itself. That's the nature of like where we are. So it doesn't mean you can't. There's not like beauty and everything, but it's a part of it. And then when you die, you can't bring anybody with you. You can't bring anybody with you. You can't even bring your own body with you. Your body's going to be taken away from you. So supposedly the only thing that you can bring with you is the kindness that you've shown to other people. It makes an imprint in your mind, and that carries, that can carry on to your next life. Or if you were a dick to people, that can follow you too. But yeah, all those things characterize like the suffering nature. That's why you say, yeah, this life is suffering.
Jay. Name the four parts of to the practice of taking yourself to a lama.
The four parts of taking yourself to lama is, the first part is having a deep faith in that lama. So without that, nothing is going to work. You should have some, done enough homework to know the lama and have developed that deep faith towards that lama. And then once you have that, you should know how to actually, how to think about that lama, how special that is, that you have that faith and that person. That's the second part, how to think about your teacher. The third one is how to act. So even if you think, you have to be very careful about how you act also. So you have to actually prepare yourself in doing that also, how to act. And the fourth one is like the whole thing of faith and thinking and acting. All thing has to be done with a lot of devotion and veneration, a deep veneration for the entire thing. So these are the four parts of how you engage with Lama. Thank you.
Ryan, can the idea of karma, that is ethics or morality, coexist with the idea of emptiness, or do they contradict each other?
Yes, it can coexist. They don't contradict with each other. Things have an empty nature. So, how do things exist? Things exist because of causes and conditions, right? Like, a tree doesn't exist on its own, even though you could look outside and be like, oh, the tree is just chilling on its own. Like, it came from a seed. Maybe someone planted the seed in the ground, so someone had an intention to plant it, or just fell to the ground. Soil, water, light, like all these things are a part of the tree existing, the tree's existence, even though just by looking at it you wouldn't tell. So it's empty of just existing as a tree, separate from those conditions, those causes and conditions. And then calling it a tree, the ability to call it a tree, like babies don't just come out of the womb being like, that's a tree, right? Like you have to like train someone, that's a tree, over and over again. You have to teach them that's a tree. Like you ever look at something and it's like a shape that looks familiar and colors, and you're like, what is that? I know what that is, right? And you're like, what is that? And you're staring at it, and your mind's like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, you look at something, and like in a magazine or something, and it's like a weird shape. And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, it's a pig, or like, oh, whatever it is, right? You're like, oh, it's the thing, right? And then you see it, and then that's like what you see, and you can't not see it. Like, those image, like the kind of optical illusion of, is it like the old woman or the young woman, right? You're like, your mind's like doing this all the time. It's like, things don't exist independent from that process happening. Your mind like labeling it that they don't exist that way. So that's what emptiness means. It means that things don't exist in a way that is like on their own, separate from the seed or the soil or the air or the whatever, the sunlight, and your mind labeling it what it is. It doesn't exist just on its own. Otherwise, there would, like, I think about it, there wouldn't be any strangers. Like, people would just, they'd be like, on me. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, you wouldn't have to learn, hey, this is on me, and, like learn about that. They exist that way, and it would be obvious from their side. It's like it's kind of like a subtle thing to think about, but things are empty of existing self-existently, so karma gives rise, like actions and you have imprints in your mind, or you learn to perceive the world in a certain way, and then you perceive the world that way because you've learned to perceive it that way, or karma, however you want to think about karma. So they rely on each other, actually. So.
Great. Everybody had a chance to ask their question.
I got another question that wasn't asked for Ryan.
I have a second one.
Okay. I think maybe we're not going to have time for second questions.
Let's do a few.
A few more questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Go
well,
ahead.
If we'll have someone's name on it, we should ask it. Right?
Name the four parts to a path of action in the act of killing, for example, as explained by J. Tsongkhapa, who follows the master of Sangha.
Sure. Do y'all know Dennis the Menace? Have you heard of Dennis the Menace?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that like cartoon. Anybody? So there's like this old guy, and he lives next to a young kid, and the kid, Dennis, is the kid, and he's a freaking, he's a menace, right? Mr. Wilson, that's his name, okay. Mr. Wilson lives next to Dennis, and Dennis, he, like, destroys his yard, and is, like, loud, and steals his mail and stuff, right? So, I don't know, he's a menace. So Mr. Wilson's like, I'm gonna kill Dennis. He's like, I've had enough, I'm gonna kill him. So, within this question, the first one is the object, the parts of a, or the path of a karma or something, I forget what it is. So the first one is the object. So Dennis is the object. So Mr. Wilt, this is all happening in Mr. Wilson's mind. So Dennis is the object. The second part is mental, the mental component of like a karmic seed. So Mr. Wilson correctly identifies Dennis. That's the first. The second, this mental part has three parts. Correct identification, mental affliction, and your motivation. So say Mr. Wilson sneaks into Dennis's room late at night, and Dennis snuck out, and he put pillows under in the bed under the blanket, and it looks like Dennis is there, but he's really not. And so did Mr. Wilson correctly identify Dennis was in the room because he wants to kill him? It looks like it, but no, right? So he didn't correctly identify it, but he's still going to carry on. He has probably a mental affliction of anger. He's probably just been pissed off for like a long time. And then the motivation would be ignorance. So Mr. Wilson thinks by killing Dennis that he'll be freeing himself of a problem, but that's an ignorant way to view the world. He's actually creating future violence for himself by killing Dennis. So the third part is doing the action. So Mr. Wilson comes up with a knife and starts stabbing the pillows. That's the action. And then the fourth part is the completion. Did he complete the act? So did he actually kill Dennis or not? So first part's the object, second part's mental, third part's doing the act, fourth part is whether you completed it or not.
Does anybody have a question with Jay's name on it?
Or any that you love?
Yeah.
Just any great question that you want answered.
I have one for Jay. Master Shantideva describes the joys of living in a forest solitude, and then urges us to spend our time there in the woods in gentle walks and thoughts of helping others through developing the wish for enlightenment. What method does Master Shantideva recommend first for meditating upon this wish?
Yeah, the method Master Shantideva suggests is exchanging self with
karma?
What does that mean?
Yeah. Long question, little answer.
Any other question? Like, even if you have any question.
How old are you?
I have a question. What are the four powers?
The four powers are power of refuge. The four powers of purification, right? Yeah. We have karma, and if we know that, we have something to purify. So we have four powers. Thanks for asking this question. I have used this and it is very effective. And the first one is power of refuge. Second one is the power of regret. And third one is power of restraint. And fourth one is the power of remedy. The refuge is actually, you know, if you have studied Dharma and if you have studied the path of wisdom and the path of compassion, you know for sure that you can put all your hopes in that path. So you actually take refuge in your teacher, the teachings and your own realizations and your Dharma brothers and sisters and also all the bodhisattvas and protectors that you are in the Sangha. So that is taking refuge, even if you have done anything really bad also, you can immediately, that is a fallback. Like, I use that every day. Anything that happens, the next second you can have an attitude of refuge and you can actually have a fresh breath of air. I do that every day. I have experienced that. The power of refuge is so powerful. And then once you have that breath of fresh air, you just regret. You regret based on your wisdom, not just ignorant regret. You know that you can take care of that. How you did that, everything comes. And then you actually regret doing that. And then you do make a resolution with yourself that you restrain, that I'm gonna not do that again. And again, there are a lot of ways you can work with. You can decide that I'm not gonna do that for one day, or 1 month, or maybe next 1 hour, I'm not gonna think about it. You know, so those kind of things. So, power of restraint, and then the power of remedy. You can do that if you have a bad conversation with somebody and you regret something. There are various ways you have to actually do something. It's not just all mental. Can be mentally doing also, but you have to actually have a remedy that you did something that is opposite to that. You can actually call them and say sorry, or you can actually write an email and not send it if it is not ready. So some kind of remedy action, you do that, and once you have done that, you actually feel good immediately. It is visceral. And then there is a fifth force, which is the rejoicing. Which is like the fertilizer. What's that picture you have?
Miracle Grow.
So you put that and the four powers become 4 million powers.
Can you give a specific example of the refuge one in your day-to-day that you said that you use?
Yeah, refuge is in my day-to-day. My interactions are with my friends and my co-workers and my family back in India. And if there is anything bad, like suppose if I get an email from a co-worker that I was not expecting, and I had a bad feeling, and then I start planning or scheming or something like that, I immediately, you know, and in that process, for example, 10 minutes pass that way. So I'm actually having a mental affliction attack at that time. I'm going through my own mental affliction is driving me. But at some point you'll actually find it. I actually find out, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then actually I can actually immediately realized that it's all my story and it's not true. It's the way the Ryan just explained how emptiness, like everything that appears to us, is not exactly the way that is. And so immediately you can actually, it gives a space and you can take a step back. And once you take a step back, you have a lot of power. And where did that power come from? It came from the teachings that you have received. It came from the teachings that have been given to you from thousands of years by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And it has been given to me because there was a Sangha which is actually built and maintained by a lot of Sangha members. So immediately the small thing becomes a big thing. Means the big mental affliction thing becomes, all of a sudden that story is forgotten. And I'm just like I created that story, I'm creating a new heaven here. So that is the power of refuge. So I'm actually totally like, oh, okay, I can take care of this and go back there. So that is how I work with refuge. Having a deep gratitude, deep faith and deep veneration for what is being given to me. In my case, I don't even think that I qualify that. There is a story that, I've heard this story about, this is a real story. In Bombay, one man was going to work near a building, and all of a sudden a book fell on his head. And then he looked up and there was a dad and scolding his son like, why do you read all these kind of books? And he's like beating the son. And then the man took the book and it was Dharma teachings. And then dad said, take that book and go, you know, we don't want that. And the guy went to work and he read that. And the long story short, he actually became a very famous Dharma teacher. So I actually feel like I've been walking like that, and my teacher and my teachings and my Sangha actually fell on my head, just like that book. You know, so when I realize that, I actually take refuge. It is actually a feeling of totally prostration, totally falling. Falling and not wanting to get up. We'll stop there. I can talk more, but thank you.
It's your turn on me.
So we now request you to each please give us a short Dharma teaching.
Okay. I'm just going to talk about dedication, like at the end of class when you dedicate the energy of whatever you're doing. It's kind of pretty powerful just to think that your actions, none of your actions are lost. Like, all of your actions are actually very meaningful and powerful, and you can direct them towards, you have the power to direct them towards kind of your goals and your wishes and your dreams. So traditionally there's three places where you can direct your dedication or that energy towards. It's from liberation in the palm of your hand, Bhupunka Rinpoche. So he says, first place is dedicate your efforts and your energy towards your spiritual realizations, like growing realizations within your heart. So not just like knowing something, but really contemplating it and thinking about it and integrating it. So it changes the way that you live. It changes the way that you react to emails. it changes your heart, like softens your heart. So may those realizations continue to grow within me, so that my heart grows bigger and bigger. And you can include like the whole world. You could say may all beings come to realize truth, I guess, kindness and love. The second would be you could dedicate it towards teachers. Like he phrases it in the way he says, being taken into the care of holy beings, holy lamas. So like, may I be taken into the care and guidance of enlightened beings, which I think is really sweet, right? Like, I'm really thankful for my parents and everything they've taught me, and school teachers, like and Dharma teachers. There's holy beings around me all the time that have been taking care of me. So may this continue, and may every being be taken into the care of holy beings, of teachers. And then you can dedicate it towards... Those two kind of lead to the third of bodhicitta, this like wish that all beings just be free. Like, may it lead to a world that doesn't have pain, that people don't react in violence. They wouldn't even think of that. It wouldn't occur to them. Like, that would be so cool, right? Like a world where people don't get angry at each other, but they like think like, oh, how could I... People like really like taking care of each other. Like, how cool would that be? Like, what if the world was full of people that were thinking about other people? That'd be pretty... If you just sit and think about it, like, there'd be a lot... Things would be a lot different. So, and may that lead to all beings like be... reach spiritual freedom, like in full enlightenment or Buddhahood. So, realizations growing in your heart, being taken into the care of kind lamas, and may it lead to a world free of suffering for all beings, or the whole universe, anywhere, any being is.
Teaching that I want to pass on today, tonight, is again based on Lojong. One of the teaching that I always try to remember and practice is the 8 verses of Lojong. So, in that, in one verse, it talks about how to see others as your mothers, all beings as your mothers. So it is like, and when you read that, it is like, oh, it is it sounds good, but what does it do? How do we practice with that? So when I started working on that, I found out that you know, there are five emotions or 5 relationships which are divine in our life. The first one is mother and child. The love and relationship between a child and mother is very divine, very special. You cannot actually, I cannot know, because I will never be a mother in this life. So, or it is not something that you can read or understand. Only if you're a mother, you can understand that. So that is an intense divine emotions. And another divine emotion is between friends. There is something, I have friends that I sometimes talk once in a year, or sometimes once in 2 years, and every time we talk after that 2 years, it is like yesterday we talked. Mm-hmm. You know, so those kind of, that kind of pure friendship is another kind of divine relationship that we have been given in our human realm. And the third one is between romantic partners, between lovers. That is also, it's not explainable. If you have experienced, you know, you have experienced it. That's also a divine relationship, divine emotion. The fifth one is a very unique relationship with your service to your teacher, your spiritual teacher. With that deeper veneration that I had the chance to talk about 3 or 4 times in this time. and the fifth one is the love of, all of them are love. Love of mother, love of a friend, love of a lover, love of towards the teacher. And the fifth one is the love of a Buddha towards everybody, that is the equanimity. So out of, all these things are actually very much part of the bhakti tradition in India, which I'll be teaching more extensively. So this is a marketing for the next week. So I'll be teaching about or talking about the other four in the next week and the week after. But about the mother thing, I'm gonna just read some of the verses from that, and then we'll sit 30 seconds for that. Take some 3 or 4 deep breaths. I'm going to read the 8 verses and we'll sit for 10 seconds after each verse. Verse 1. With the determination to accomplish the highest happiness for all sentient beings, who surpass even a wish-fulfilling jewel, I will learn to hold them supremely dear. I associate with others, I will learn to think of myself as the lowest among all and respectfully hold others as being supreme from the depth of my heart. In all actions, I will learn to search into my own mind, and as soon as an affective emotion arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly face and avert it. I will cherish beings of bad nature and those oppressed by strong negativities and sufferings, as if I had found a precious treasure which is very difficult to find. When others out of jealousy treat me badly, with abuse, slander, and so on, I will learn to take all loss to myself and offer the victory to them. When one whom I have benefited with great hope unreasonably hurts me very badly, I will learn to view that person as an excellent spiritual guide. I will learn to offer to everyone without exception all help and happiness directly and indirectly, and secretly take upon myself all the harms and sufferings of my mothers. I will learn to keep all these practices undefiled by the stains of eight worldly conceptions, and by understanding all phenomena to be like illusions, I will be released from the bondage of attachment.
Tibetan tradition, after the 18-20 years of study, the candidates would appear in these big public debates that would go on for days and days, and it was grueling circumstances, being their understanding being challenged by the greatest scholars and practitioners that existed. And so if they succeed, just like we've been grilling these guys, but at the end, they would always ask the same question in the centuries of these types of debates. Their final question would always be the same. And at the end of that question, assuming they get it right, then we get to celebrate. So everybody take a hat, because remember the picture of the yellow hats? They would throw their hats in the air in celebration, make a lot of noise. So if everything goes well, and after Abhi's going to ask the final question, then we get to do the same thing, and then party on.
The highest pointed tip means highest wisdom.
You should take a noise.
They're not dunce hats, they're wisdom hats.
Everyone have one?
Go.
Hold on to that hat. So Ryan and Jay, we learn that this whole world is nothing but suffering, that there is suffering of body and suffering of mind, that even the good things must end. And so even when we think things are pleasurable, they're suffering. Is there an end to this suffering?
Yes.
Yes.
And why is there an end? Why do you say that there's an end to this suffering?
Because the love overcomes hate.
And wisdom always overcomes ignorance.
Yay!
Yeah.
So Ryan and Jay, Maroke means guide. It means that you're becoming spiritual guides. You've now studied for many, many years. You've studied many hours. You've sat your butt on the cushion for hours. You've brought this into your life and transformed your hearts and your minds. And I've seen both of you. Your lives have completely changed from the day that each of you walked in the door. So with this presentation, you are receiving your certificate of Maroke, the proof that you can put up on your wall, right? That says you are indeed certified to teach these ACI courses yourself. So this is a great blessing and a great joy, and it's also a responsibility which I bestow on you to take this mantle and please spread the Dharma in each of your own unique, special, beautiful, wonderful ways. So this is an auspicious day where we as a Sangha welcome these two new teachers into our community to carry on to teach us. We ask you please continue to teach us. And it's also an auspicious day because these are the first Dharma teachings we've received in our new space for Diamond Light. Because we are now going to become the owners of this space. Completely, they will be ours. What? So know that not only have you blessed us with your teachings and with becoming Maroke, but you are the first teachers to give teachings in this new space.
Yay!
Yay!
I almost started singing "Happy Birthday."
So you have now been born into the family of the Buddhas, or the family of teachers.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Yay!
Yay!
Thank you.
Dedicate and celebrate.
Yeah,
okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to do our closing prayers and dedications, and then please stay and celebrate and partake of this wonderful food and give your congratulations and enjoy.
Ching ne to chong ri ra lin chi nen de gen pa di sang ge shing du mi te u a gi dro kun lam da ching la shu pa shu iram guru
and we'll end with three prostrations together.
take all of the noise and hats back in that one basket, and all of the questions actually can go back in
the question basket.
Yeah.
Big questions, and I'm gonna remember.